Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We love having you. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we will get started on the issues of the day. First of all, if a J.P. Miller is listening from the Empire Report, feel free to come back.
We want to hear from you, J.P.
I just told J.P. that we didn't have a seat for him, and we do have a seat for him. We were sort of right the first time, and so if J.P. wants to come back, we would love to have him back. All right.
Right.
But thank you. If you're listening, J.P., please. Joining me for the discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She's communications consultant, and we love having her. She joins us several times during the week, and we love having her. Thank you very much for being here.
And what a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Absolutely gorgeous. Also, we welcome a brand new panelist to our airwaves. And let me introduce this man through this. This is one of the best titles I've ever gotten. Epidemiological Spatial Analyst.
I get the epidemiological. I think I know what analyst
spatial
is, but I don't know about the spatial part.
An environmentalist and past president of the Sierra Club, Aaron Mayer.
I make disease maps, Al.
What did you think?
Disease maps, Al.
Disease maps.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so cool.
You know,
so in other words, in the paper this morning, there was a big story about the rise of syphilis in America.
Well, that was not my particular project, but I mean, you can map.
So you'd see it in a map of the United States, and
absolutely,
you'd see a blot over in Colorado and New York, and
that's
where the syphilis is.
That's what my father did for a living.
That's right.
Yeah.
He chased syphilis.
He was an epidemiological control officer for the federal government.
No, it's one of the things that's really fun. It's a great profession. I mean, you get to see trends and patterns. I mean, you don't use you do use spreadsheets and the tables, but, you know, data and tables tend to be kind of boring. It's when you lay them on a map that you then get the chance of not only knowing what's happened and how significant, but actually locations and where. And so where do you concentrate those efforts of analysis and research?
Well, that is cool.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
That's cool. And so right now we know that we had Lyme disease coming out of those ticks, but now we have this other thing, this viral thing, and that's virtually killing people. Not that Lyme doesn't do a good job at doing some of that, but this is really serious stuff.
Well, this is why we need to, you know, definitely when we talk about the government rolling back on NIH, funding as well as EPA funding, and denying climate change, what we have is a fundamental shift in the various zones with regards to temperature, areas such as the Northeast that were cooler and had four seasons are now going down to three seasons. They're getting warmer. Areas that, like the Piedmont areas of the South, are now becoming more tropical. So disease vectors are starting to migrate north. And so, I mean, it's a point in which people definitely should look at and be concerned about. But it's one of those things, because they think that climate change is only about the greenhouse gases, but you also have to talk about what are all the other things that are going to be shifted and affected and impacted by it.
I predict that JP is going to come back.
Did he come back?
I thought I saw something out there.
Well, I don't know. Is that Ian or?
No. Can you imagine Morning Joe? Can you imagine Morning Joe or one of those morning programs or Chris Cuomo or whatever saying, "Hello, if you left, come back."
You know what? I think I heard that actually once, but we're very bad at math, JP. You have so many chairs, you have so many people, and I lost track.
He thought he was fired.
I lost track.
Now, if we were to yell out, "Judy Patrick, come back from the media
JP,
project."
JP, Judy Patrick.
Well, I thought Judy was staying, and then because I saw Judy, and then she had all of her stuff, and I thought she walked into the studio, and then she left.
Yeah.
And then you were here, so.
So okay. Why didn't you call back Judy?
Because I don't think Judy was expected to stay, and you were expecting to stay.
No, she looked like she had a mission when she
got
out of here.
Yeah. People often have that mission just to get the hell out of the building. I don't know. So, thank you. So J.P. Miller is with us. He's publisher of the Empire Report, and he is with us, too. And he was nice enough to listen to his radio at my plea By the way, I didn't mention. You've been talking about your environmental work, but also very much a political animal too, right?
Well, absolutely. For the past 3 decades, another part of my mapping is doing reapportionment, and I've been a technical consultant with regards to redistricting and reapportionment. In fact, I anticipated the red map that happened. In fact, I was trying to get Democrats to brace for that and prepare and actually try to meet it head on. But like anything else, it's one of those things that they figure that they can put off until tomorrow, and then tomorrow consumes them, and next thing you know, they're in a hole. But
well, I know what you are. You're a gerrymanderer.
Well, I resemble that remark, but I actually like to call myself a person who likes to expand democracy for all. So I have a little bit more of, a nonpartisan streak, since I don't do it for a political party.
Oh, you don't? So you don't work for the Democrats in the state assembly, who have done an incredible job of feathering their own nests.
Well, in fact, I spent a lot of time going after Democrats and some of their partisan gerrymanders. But the point of the matter is, it's about raw power. It's about political power. It's one of the rare times in every 10 years where a politician gets to choose his population rather than the population choosing its politician. So it's a very complex but yet simple process. But most people, because it only comes up every 10 years, because you have to scale up right then and there to meet the law and deadlines, that it can be overwhelming. And then it's fraught with all the politics that you're used to.
Well, and yet, I've often talked about how, the leaders, whether they be, Shelley Silver or anybody else, goes to a room and on the wall is a gigantic computer. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, great computer, draw me districts where we can't lose. Now, the Republicans in the New York State Senate really have had a tough time about that, because finally the computer, like the in Snow White or whatever that was, look back and say, there
the mirror in Snow White?
mirror on the wall.
Yes.
So the computer looks back at the Republican leader and says, not enough people to push around.
Right. Well, the thing is that they have some very talented people, within the Republican side. In fact, when you do reapportionment, you get to know the handful of people who actually really do the work, who actually really do the data, who actually really draw the maps. There's what you call your committees, which you have all these people who posture and look like they're really doing the work, but actually there's a lot of technical analysts and wonks that are really doing it.
Now we know what you do.
Okay.
Hello.
Alan Chartok is here as well. I didn't officially introduce you.
No.
So we have Alan Chartok, we have Aaron Mayer, we have J.P. Miller.
The return of J.P.
Teresa
Bourgeois. You almost got out the door. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get started. Thank you very much for joining us. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Again, Alan Chartok, Aaron Mayer, J.P. Miller, Teresa Bourgeois. I'm Joe Donahue. We got everybody's name right. We actually have seats at the table. We're good to go. We start with this story from the New York Times. Trump widens rift with Congress as critical showdowns loom. Yesterday, there was a statement made by the president basically said that he was willing to shut down the government if he didn't get his wall. And he had widened an extraordinary rift with his own party as he threatened that government shutdown over the border wall, attacked key lawmakers whose votes he needs heading into a crucial legislative period. The escalating tensions between the Republican president and the Republican Congress endanger delicate negotiations in the coming weeks to overhaul the tax system, keep the government running, and avoid a costly default on the country's debt. They are the clearest signs to date that the uncomfortable alliance between Donald Trump, who won the presidency promising to drain the swamp, and Republican lawmakers who hope to enact long-stalled conservative priorities has begun to fray. Alan Chartok.
Look, the McConnell thing is unbelievable. This is This has got Democrats with some hope. You know, I mean, you're going into 2018, Mitch McConnell having to protect his incumbents, which is very hard to do when you know that Trump is still popular with many people in the in the Republican Party. So it's really a going to be a very tough thing for McConnell now, whose wife, of course, is in the Trump cabinet, who says she believes in standing by her men. You know, now, apparently there were some real expletives. We could only guess what they were. That's why I like when they say expletives were used in this conversation.
Between McConnell and Trump.
Yeah, because what it means is it's always worse than if you really know the word. Oh, I know that word. But if you say expletives, you know, it's really something. Anyway, it's bad news. He's got to protect his incumbents on the one hand. Number two, he's got to get some things through his house. It's not going to be easy.
Now, apparently, there were also several calls in reporting from the Washington Post, Politico, and the New York Times, there were also many calls that were made to various senators and congressional leaders regarding Russia. And the president, again, in an expletive-laden pattern of speech, trying to halt whatever action is being taken when it comes to the Russia investigation. This apparently has happened over the past week and a half, bringing up the question if Robert Mueller is looking at an obstruction of justice charge in the firing of James Comey, is this again adding fuel to that fire of obstruction of justice?
Well, I take a little bit of a departure from Alan. I think that, you know, one of the first things is that Trump is a master showman and master salesman. Remember, it was his thing that we're going to build that wall, and who was going to pay for it? Mexico. And what better way to distract your base and distract, as I say, politicians than to get into, as I say, the reported tirade with the Senate Majority Leader McConnell, and have that being the lead, and having still this issue of the wall, but people are not really keeping careful track. They're just focused on all of the what I call Trump in awe, not shock in awe, but Trump in awe. And so you have people's heads spinning. But meanwhile, what people are not paying attention to is that he's actually filling a swamp here. What's he doing? He's asking for over $3 billion to be appropriated from American taxpayers, not Mexico, but American taxpayers, to build this wall. And so he's beating up on Arizona politicians. He's going into, and I mean, just think the cojones on this gentleman to go into Arizona, and the senators there are saying, hey, wait a minute, it was your promise, your campaign promise, to pay for this wall through charging Mexico. We cannot appropriate money for that. We have a number of pressing priorities. We have tax cuts and tax breaks. The last thing we want to do is, as I say, lard up the bill with paying for the wall. So I think that Trump is doing this beautiful covfefe move. I think that we're getting distracted here with all the noise about this tension. Yes. One of the things that Mitch McConnell does, Mitch McConnell will do his rope-a-dope. We know that Mitch McConnell is not the big theatric guy, but Trump is putting on a show. The media is falling for it. The Democrats, in my opinion, instead of seizing upon this moment and saying, how is Mexico paying for this? I mean, the silence on the Democratic Party side, not taking advantage of this opportunity.
They're doing exactly the right thing by not opening their mouths. Let them. They're getting a lot of criticism for it, but right. I think they're exactly right.
So let the other side kill themselves.
Well, right. It has not worked. I think that, this is one of the things that part of the Hillary campaign was that, Trump is going to take himself. But people don't like that tip. I think this is one of those times we want to see some leadership from the Democratic Party in holding up that record. But this is an opportunity to hold up the record. It's not stepping into the fight, but calling him on, saying, listen, if you're saying this is your economic plan is going to pay for itself and we can do this at zero cost to the American taxpayer, the Democrats should be right now, waving red meat.
So if you were Chuck Schumer right now, you'd be up there yelling, I would not. We are, as you indicate, in severe disagreement on this one. I think they're doing a fine job. And I want to point out one other thing, because I know we're going to have to go to a break, Joe, and that is these senators who he is ticking off the way he is, Trump, mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. these are the very senators who are going to have to hold up their hands when an impeachment resolution comes out of the House of Representatives to trial there. And don't think any of these guys are going to forget this.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think they also care about party loyalty. I think they care about party discipline. I also think they care about party brand. And so they have been already going to the wall to do everything they can to moot any investigation and slow things down. I think to the extent that Democrats can stand up and speak up and put pressure on them, and I think by speaking up, they actually add to the infighting because, again, last thing you want to have—
But they're letting the press do their work for them, and I think that's correct.
But the press is, as I say, losing to Trump's base.
All right. That's round one. I'm going to put that on pause, and then I'm going to let JP and Teresa go at it when we come back. You see what you're up against, all right? Pit the two of you together.
It's like team wrestling.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Tag them in, and then we'll go to them when we come back. We will welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. A full panel this morning. A lot to discuss. Alan Chartok, Aaron Mayer, J.P. Miller, Teresa Bourgeois, and your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Keep them brief, keep them to the point, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. We will be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 24th of August, and a lovely morning, as Teresa mentioned before, 9:34 on Thursday morning. So round one, as I mentioned, both Aaron and Alan taking on the subject of the wall. JP, what do you make of all of this?
The wall. So Trump has had a challenging first 6 months, to say the least. And his base.
We've had a challenging.
Yes. And so he wants to deliver for his base. And his base would much rather have a wall than health care or tax cuts. And so he has leverage over Congress. Congress does not want to shut down the government. And he sees this as something that he can deliver to his base legislatively with Congress's help that will help him. And I think that I don't think it's a bad move on his part.
So why am I so mad at Paul Ryan for during his town hall after all of this, of him turning around saying, well, we absolutely need the wall, and that is one of our top priorities?
Well, I think there's a lack of discussion in the media about the merits of the wall. So he proposed a wall in his campaign. I think it was his number one thing that he ran on. He then won the presidency, and the media is against the wall, and I don't think that they think – now, I'm not saying the wall is good or bad, but let's talk about the merits of, will this slow the heroin epidemic that's racking our country? I think most of the heroin that comes from our country – that comes into our country comes from Mexico. Will this slow illegal immigration? And I think there's been a lack of discussion on the merits of the advocacy of the wall.
Well, I saw Teresa make a real face while you were talking.
Yeah, I thought a lot of that was debunked. But Teresa, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting question, is why do you think the people want the wall? And do they really want the wall, or is it a symbol of something else?
Of keeping those people out.
Those people out because people are economically disadvantaged. They're economically insecure, and they feel like though what he did is divide people and say, those people are taking your jobs. And that's not what a president should do, but this is what this one did. And the wall then becomes the symbol of this notion that those people are making it hard for you people. I'm on your side. I'm going to bring the economy back. And so then the wall, do people really understand the wall? But the bottom line is, during the campaign, we need to have both sides of what he said. We're going to build a wall, and Mexico is going to pay for it. So how does he explain how he wants $1.7 billion to pay for it?
Well, and also let us not lose sight of the fact in our discussion this morning that the reason we're talking about this is right now is because he said it's worth a government shutdown. It's worth shutting down the entire government to get this wall.
Right. Well, we need to step back and understand and this gets way too wonky, but shutdowns are really expensive. They are politically expensive. What did people most not want? They don't want gridlock. What is the ultimate gridlock? Government shutting down. So they're politically expensive, but they're also financially very, very expensive to the
economy. And Newt Gingrich is out of politics right now because of his move to shutting things down.
Remember the crybaby New York Post headline, front page, crybaby.
Well, it's, again, you mentioned a very fundamental piece. I think that there has not been a robust discussion on the merits of why the wall, why now, why are you willing to shut the government down? And I think that, again, the Democrats are missing a profound opportunity of that us versus them dialogue. I mean, the hidden pieces, you know, we can cloud in the heroin epidemic or
that's
other
some
things.
Afghanistan,
but
by the way.
But the real issue there is the nativist aspect of this wall. This was speaking, because remember, we have militia people that are patrolling the border. We have all these patriot guys, all the gun guys. You have a lot of this whole narrative of the us versus them and the notion of our America being overrun by, you know, all these brown folks coming over the border, which is really not true. But the point of the matter is that we have an opportunity to discuss the merits of the wall, and by not engaging, by not really challenging and pressing and forcing that conversation, I think the Democrats are missing a very powerful opportunity of, A, leadership, but also moving forward with the pluralistic narrative of what America is and what we do stand for.
Well, Aaron, it ain't over yet.
Oh,
but
I understand that. But I think
the
thing is that when do you get in that conversation? And I think that—
when it gets serious.
I think that, you know, it's serious right now. I mean, when you're talking about shutting down the government— and over a promise you made about another sovereign state paying for a political outcome that you so desire, and you're willing to beat up your fellow Republicans, I think the Democrats can actually,
but
you
let's,
know.
But when you talk about the Democrats getting involved, we also have to keep, it seems the Democrats also have to keep the eye on the prize as to who they're going to run. And I mean, this is also someone emerging as an actual leader and someone who also has some command of the party.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton has just written a new book. MSNBC got a hold of it, an audio clip in which basically she says, "I should have answered him. I should have answered him. I should have let him. I should have let him have it when he was doing that. I was playing a different kind of role." And I think she's right.
No, I think the Democratic Party needs a major overhaul and a major retooling in the wake of that past election and analysis, but also how it is approaching, you know, the national conversation on a number of things. And I think that right now the leadership is not showing the strength that it needs. I think it's fraught national when they went to elect their current national chairman. Was just as chaotic and dysfunctional. They're still infighting, you know, with the Bernie people, et cetera, rather than how do we reflect our talk, meaning of being an inclusive tent. The Democrats themselves are not having that issue of inclusivity of the side.
I think you made that point earlier this week, Teresa, about the Bernie faction of working very hard of getting people in the state elections, very progressive candidates who are probably have quite an uphill battle in those particular
states. Very enthusiastic,
states.
But
right.
Can't win. And I think there needs to be a more methodical approach to filling these seats and how to tap that and work that enthusiasm to a way that it's you get a positive outcome in the elections. But let's go. I mean, the other thing, back to the policy and McConnell and the Democrats and the Republicans, all of this, you know, September is a critical month. And Bannon and others said this. This is their key month because
wrap up the fiscal year.
Right. You have to raise the debt limit and you need to pass a budget.
Yep.
And then there are a number of other key things that are hanging out there. And one of them is, you know, among other things, Child Health Plus, 8 million, 9 million children's health insurance. The funding is set to expire at the end of the month. So there are a number of things that these folks have to sit down and work through and get done. And so the question is, will the Senate and the House do this with the administration, or will they get into a room separate from the administration, grind it out, and put something on the table and say, President, you're going to sign this because the Republicans can't shut down the government with the Republicans all in charge?
It doesn't seem, JP, like any of those are possibilities right now, given what we've seen over the past 7 months.
Right, and Trump has no interest in seeing these Republicans win re-election. They have railroaded his priorities just as much as the Democrats would, and so he sees the funding of this wall as something where he has leverage. Trump understands leverage. He doesn't understand getting along with people and working together, and them saying, well, you know, this is going to cost $3 billion that we don't have. The government has done creative accounting for decades and decades and decades.
$3
billion is nothing. The state of New York spends $260 billion a year. Andrew Cuomo has $8 billion a year in his slush fund. $3 billion to start a wall is really a drop in the bucket for the federal government. It's amazing that the media and all have all of a sudden become fiscal conservatives on how much money government should spend. And Trump says this is a gift to my base. You see what he wants to do for his base, what you saw with his comments last week with Charlottesville. He wants to deliver this for his base.
In the meantime, I love what Aaron said about nativist. He used the word nativist before, because if you were up as early as I get up, you heard on the BBC this morning a terrible story about how the Germans, I guess it was in Frankfurt, but I'm not sure, burned down a house which had, you know, Syrian refugees in it. You know, it's the same the worldwide. They're not me. Kill them. And that's a big part of the Trump program.
Got a couple of letters. Let's do those, and then we'll go to a break.
All right, here we go. Tim writes, I agree with Alan. That's the one I chose to read first. I agree with Alan on the Democrats' silence on the border wall. To quote Napoleon, never interfere with your enemy when he is making a mistake. There you go. All right. And then we heard from a very interesting person, Teresa, who says she woke up at 5:30 to a bat in the bedroom. Now the question, get the shots. We say, Teresa, check in with your medical professional.
Just to be clear, that's a different Teresa.
Yeah, it's not you. But the question, the question I would have for you, Teresa, is did the bat bite you? I'm sure that's what the doctor is going to, who you're going to see, yeah, and who will be definitive.
You just have a bat. That's the.
We had a bat, yeah, as I told you the other day. And
that's probably why they wrote you, because they knew
on the bat
that you could bat. you could rap on the bat level.
You might call me
Batty.
Batty.
Batman.
Oh, Batman.
I went a whole different direction.
Why did none of us go there?
And then Russ sent in this missile. You're missing the big picture. Trump's third party has profoundly changed the locus of power in the federal government. His inability to hire competent civil service or offer coherent policies has led not only to the outsourcing of critical diplomacy to the military, but has also focused legislative power in congressional oversight committees, where influence peddling is far cheaper than bulk campaign financing. Okay, it was a way too long letter, and that's all of it I'm going to read.
And with that, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go move on to other stories and talk about more stuff. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Aaron Mayer, J.P. Miller, and Teresa Bourgeois. We have the next story I thought was interesting because there were two versions of it, one in The New York Times, one in The Washington Post. The Washington Post story is headlined, Trump's Whiplash, Three Personas in Three Speeches, But the Same President. The New York Times version of basically the same story is different day, different audience, and a completely different president. So the point of these articles, meaning basically making that you look at the speech that was made on Monday to the nation on Afghanistan, then you look at the rally that was done in Phoenix, and then you look at the speech that he made in Reno, right? Reno, Nevada, yesterday, and you look at those, some on prompter, some off prompter, some a mix of both, and three very different approaches and very different things, to which the I believe it was the Washington Post said, a whiplash, an occasional, this whiplash meaning that in the span of 48 hours, President Trump has boomeranged among three roles, the commander-in-chief, the divider, and the uniter.
I think it's a very interesting commentary on how he views the media cycle. I remember when President Bush and President Clinton were in office, they would say, what is our message for the week going to be? And they had a very purposeful message for that week. And it seems like Donald Trump has, what is going to be my message for the next 12 hours? I'm then going to shift to something else 12 hours later. It's certainly purposeful on his part.
Yeah, but to what end?
Well, I think that it's part of his salesmanship. Again, people are losing the fact that he's a master of form, okay? So when he's standing in Fort Myer before the military, he is doing his prompter thing. He knows that I have to look.
Yeah, but Aaron, it's on TV. Everybody gets to see it.
Understood. And I think that it's it's both knowing the audience that you're at, because I think he's situationally aware. But he's also, you know, the TV, he gets to nullify with the fake news. I mean, he's always going to trot that out. But when he's there in front of, say, like the military, he's going to try to present that role as stable commander in chief, albeit reading from the script and reading from the teleprompter. But when he goes to the people, to the rally format, again, the form becomes more animated. He lets loose. He gets to do his fire and brimstone. But he is, I would say, he's really on message. I think he still is pushing that Unite the Right theme
that
his base craves and demands.
Well, he is. But on the other hand, more and more people are writing about his psychological positioning, which is that he's not consistent on anything, and that he may be, in fact, in some mental health trouble.
I think to rational thinking folks, as Jay pointed out, you know, there is a logical cycle. I mean, we talk about the institution of the president and what we have been conditioned to throughout our lives, and it's been, say, from the mid-20th century to now, we have this sense of the institutional president. This guy comes in and you got P.T. Barnum.
Yes, but you also got a 34% approval rating.
Right.
I mean, you seem to be implying that it's working for him. It's not. It's going in exactly the wrong direction. He's ticked off everybody in the Republican Party, in the Republican Senate, and many in the House.
Right. He has a 34% approval rating, but again, don't be deceived by the math, because at the end of the day, it's 34% of the electorate, and then the issue is, I mean, when you split that in half, what is that Republican base that's going to turn
huge.
Out for him?
It's
that. It is that Tea Party, I'm tired of government, I'm mad as hell. And like I said, again, people get lost in the big number,
but
the 30%
average.
But at the narrow, it's about the short. And he is playing the short game, and he's playing it insanely masterful. You know,
he's
doing that colorful Howard Beale. Remember that network? And people are shouting out the window. They're tired of it. But again, you know, at the end of the day, things are getting done, and people are saying, well, but
what
no, he's
getting
he's,
done. What's getting
because
done?
Because he has the courts. He's got a lot of the rulemaking. It's the regulatory apparatus. The thing that he criticizes, the big state, I call it the real state, that he is still pushing through his appointments, a agenda. Listen, he's gotten rid of the scientific committee for the EPA. He's wiped out the entity that validates and, as they say, provides sound empirical analysis for, as they say, regulation. They are your quality control with regards to reports and studies. I mean, he is doing things at a substantive, deep level. He is firing people. He's not appointing people. You got a Department of State that's running on about 40% capacity, while at the same time he's going mad and bonkers with Kim Jong-un.
Aaron, I have to say, I do not agree with you. I think he's doing terribly. And I think he is doing so badly.
He's doing terribly with normal people.
underneath all of this sound and fury, on this I agree with Aaron that we need more focus on this. Underneath all this sound and fury and kerfuffle going on in the country, which I think has its all series of dangers, he has put 137 at last count judges, this is McConnell, held up these judges for a year more, prevented President Obama from filling these seats, which clogged the courts, created tremendous backlog in our judicial process. And so he has quickly gone in and filled these seats with young, very radical conservative judges that are going to be there for a long, long time, plus all of the regulatory changes. Read this New York Magazine article about HUD. They did a deep dive. ProPublica worked with New York Magazine reporter, did a deep dive into what's going on at HUD when no one's paying attention. And he's putting in people who have no experience. They're making incredibly dangerous regulatory changes, or they're doing nothing.
Okay, so what is the point that both of you are making here? So he's doing these things. You say he's getting things done. I don't think he's getting substantive things done. But let's assume you're right about the judges. What is the point that you're trying to make in terms of our politics?
What I'm trying to say is every time people said he's not getting anything done, he's not getting anything done legislatively, but we got to stop saying he's not getting anything done because he's making fundamental changes. Plus, because of his tone, his tenor, his behavior, he's changing the whole global dynamic. China is so much stronger than it was before. When you say, who's the leader of the free world? It's not the president of the United States anymore. It's Angela Merkel of Germany. So on so many different levels, this has created a shift. And obviously, this issue of these articles has bothered him because he tweeted just a little while ago about it, trying to explain this away.
But on the issue of judges, it's a very important piece. You know, I think that once you get strict textualists at that court level, various federal circuit levels, you're going to have to start dealing with the litigation that starts to challenge rules and the enforcement of rules. And if you have judges that are, as they say, pro-business, anti-environment, so you're talking about major rollbacks in not enforcing the Antiquities Act or major changes when environmental organizations or other organizations go to sue, the new case law that's going to be coming out of these courts and these regions, you know, will be major precedents. There will be fundamental shifts and divergence from, existing rules and norms that one would come to expect from a healthy, functioning government and civil society. So the judicial branch is a very significant institution. And the regulatory function of the executive branch to interpretate the laws and then implement the laws and regulations of the land. I think that, right now, the failure of regulation, the failure to enforce is critical because grassroots organizations are going to have to, as I say, deepen their pockets with regards to litigation. So it's going to be a financial drain on your opposition. So, no, I think that there is a lot of procedural method to the madness. I think that there are a lot of individuals in the regulated community that actually see great benefit in this president distracting in his, as they say, as the head executive.
So how come they're deserting him in droves, these very influential CEOs and everybody else?
Well, that's a very – the thing is that, you know, hate can only go so far. When you start playing the game of us and them, and when you start further defining what that us is, and when you start saying, as the Unite the Right folks have been pointing out, the blood and soil, they're talking about a particular class of whites. And when you start going after African Americans and Jews in very crystal clear tones, and that you move from this notion of an inclusive America, what I call the 14th Amendment America, where if you're born here, you're an American, versus an America for the white. When you start to define who the us and who the them are, then even businessmen realize that that's bad for business. It's a big deal.
Very quickly, one of the things I think is clear is he makes this all about him. Most presidents make it all about the country, and he has made this all about him. We're all talking about him as opposed to the problems of the country.
I think the reason those CEOs left him is for profit reasons. You see why Fox News dumped Bill O'Reilly. You see why Fox News dumped a number of their anchors, and that's for profit. And as soon as a guy like Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase or Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone, as soon as they have a consumer group that wants to boycott their products and really hurts the bottom line, they don't love Trump that much. So his dedication from CEOs and establishment Republicans is razor thin.
Then who is he doing it for? You all make this persuasive argument that he, on some level, he may be succeeding. Succeeding in what? If you talk about Jamie Dimon, I don't get that.
Right. Has he diminished himself or the presidency? What do you think?
He's become president of the United States. That's not a diminishment from what Trump was before.
Well, that was a big upgrade. Yeah. That was an upgrade. Yeah.
I think the
institution, he's damaging the institution. That you can do. You know, you can't diminish the institution because it has its role as the head of state and before the world. That is, he is the flag of our nation. So I think that you're not diminishing the presidency, but the institution of the president, he is clearly damaging and tarnishing, because again, these are legacies that you gain over time and they can easily be squandered.
We're going to take a pause there. When we come back, we'll continue and finish out the rest of the show. We want to go to news with Ray Graff. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 5 minutes past 10 o'clock on the 24th of August. Alan Chartok, Aaron Mayer, J.P. Miller, and Teresa Bourgeois. I'm Joe Donahue. Welcome, and we welcome your letters as well. panel@wamc.org. Get ready, Alan. And that's where we get letters like these.
Oh, like these. Okay. Morning, says Martin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Democrats need to adopt a Big Tent philosophy and endorse more socially conservative candidates in conservative districts. The Republicans have used this tactic effectively to gain majorities. Too many liberal voters boycott candidates in elections because the, quote, perfect candidate is not on the ballot. That is a major reason why Hillary lost. Have we not learned? The big issue that unites us is greater than those that divide us. Well, you know, I know that I've said in the past that that's exactly right. You got to get 218 votes in the House of Representatives, or you have zero power in an institution that is clearly an oligarchy ruled by one person.
Well, sure. But I disagree. I think that when you have a foreign state interfering and tampering with our elections, which this has happened, there was a perfect storm of an FBI, a very zealous FBI director, you know, making an announcement in the height of a political campaign that would change the results by releasing damaging information. Plus, you have an active, an active intelligence effort by the Soviet state to influence who was going to be our leader. I think a lot of things happened. And I don't think it had little to do with the substance of the debate.
What do you disagree with? Do you disagree with the fact if we have a conservative Democrat who might win in a district, or that we shouldn't nominate such a person?
Well, I think we should always be a party of ideas and a party of Big Tent. And I think I'm not sure what conservative means in that regard.
Well, but okay,
John Tester in Montana.
No, yeah. we know what it means. Let's not fool around about that.
But the long and short, I think that, you know, it like anything else, I think that you end up getting the politician that you support in the region. I think politicians this is one of the things that the genius of Newt Gingrich, whereby he went after all the little local races. He took over the state houses, et cetera, the assemblies and the Senate, and he ran, you know, in those districts very hard. I think that the Democratic Party has always been trying to navigate from Washington, D.C., rather than the grassroots.
Aaron, yes or no, should the Democratic Party nominate somebody in a particular district who matches the worldview of that district or not? And the answer is, we have many listeners who write us and say, no, absolutely not. They have to be ideologically pure. And I say to them, no, you're wrong. We have to get 200, if you're in the Democratic Party, right, you have to get 218 votes.
Well, I think that's what your party platform is. It's not ideologically pure. I'm a platformist. So I believe that if you have a particular party platform, these are the values that your candidates at a minimum should be standing for. And I think that
If you lose the House of Representatives.
Well, the thing is that, you know, it's not even if you lose the House of Representatives, because it's not that, you know, Democrats are losing on their platforms. I just think that we have very poor set of, as I say, direction and leadership with regards to our party in pushing and supporting our progressive ideas. I think that one of the things that did come out as a result of this past election is how the Democrat DNC had put its finger on the scale relative to Bernie Sanders rather than having it being at very.
And how did they do that, really?
Well, I'm not going to relitigate it, but the point of the matter is, I think that the institution weighed in, and as I say, just let's talk about how they held up his access to data because of one of his campaign workers inappropriately had accessed Hillary Clinton's database. But they made a big federal court case out of it.
And they gave her the debate questions.
And so, I mean, there are a number of things there. And I think that, first and foremost, had they been a straight up, I think we would have something very different.
Okay, Teresa, you wanted to make a point?
No. I've a broken record on this, and I know a lot of the listeners don't like it, but I think that you have to work to find the candidates, the right Democratic candidates who can prevail in a congressional district. And different districts have different moods and temperaments, and I don't mean moods and temperaments, but different philosophical base, and that the Democrats have to be very, very strategic about trying to help foster the right candidates for the right district so that they win. But I also think, Aaron, you're absolutely right. The Democrats have to not think just about the presidential race and the House and Senate races, but you have to fill school boards, you have to fill Assembly and Senate offices.
It's turnout.
And you really
it's absolutely
need
turnout.
To
it is turnout. And we're
going to
have a huge turnout in this election.
But people have to register to vote and have an ID.
Okay, Keith says, shut the government down. I think that the government usually, in quotes, provides good services and governance for the U.S. Typically, I am vehemently opposed to government shutdowns, but this Trump administration is doing such harm to the U.S. that we need the government shut down as long as possible. This became apparent to me after watching Trump these past 2 weeks, and now his transgender ban. Keith, I vehemently disagree with you. I got to tell you, his whole thing is shutting the government down and has been from the very beginning.
Because he doesn't understand governance. He understands the politics of him winning or losing. But when you shut down the government, it's very costly to the economy. Look at the markets are dropping again today. And why? They say what they're shaken by is this notion of a government shutdown and not raising the debt limit.
And Robert says, does anybody really think that Trump has personally chosen any judges or department officials? He's simply signing when and where he's told to. Anything he tried to accomplish on his own, Obama can repeal, building the wall, et cetera. Obamacare, repeal, building the wall, etc., has been an abject failure. Thank God, Bob from Albany, although Teresa and Aaron have both made the point that they put an awful lot of judges who will be there forever.
Right. And the thing is, it's not just about whether he personally chooses. There is an ideological apparatus.
Sure.
And that ideological apparatus has a pipeline of professionals, and they've been out there in the woodwork. And let's make it very clear, once you control the executive and legislative branch, you then fast-track your agenda by appointing a judicial branch that's very favorable to deregulations, et cetera.
Sure. Richard, not Ricard. We had a little kerfuffle. A couple of our people have been reading Ricard Strauss. Richard Strauss as opposed to Ricard.
Ricard.
I thought I would mention that. Richard says, hi, panel. I'm always hearing Trump touted as a master salesman, but how many of his master sales have ended in bankruptcy? Me, I'm waiting on Mueller. And James says, finally, a real panel instead of cheerleading resistance. Alan does not understand that Trump is going to destroy the Democratic Party, leaving two parties of different makeup. And that's from James with Jim, a PhD. We hear from him often, Jim, PhD. Okay. Stephen says, remember, a government shutdown means every non-essential employee gets locked out and little, if anything, gets done. However, all of these non-essential employees will get paid for all the time they were supposed to be working. So all a shutdown really accomplishes is nothing gets done. Talk about oxymoron potential, but doesn't save any money. And that's from Stephen from Pine Bush. Laurie says, it seems to me that this threat of shutting down the government, Trump's version of stamping his feet and saying, I'll hold my breath until I turn blue. His ego is threatened. It is also a destruction from other I'm so sorry. It says destruction, but it's a distraction from other subjects like Russia. And where are those tax returns? Unfortunately, it seems that his discretion tactics, and there have been many distractors, are effective. And Joe says, many of the heroin comes from Afghanistan way of Mexico. Mary says, today is my 60th birthday. I don't really care about the wall, but I have a job which I'm paid with benefits. I would love to retire and pass this great job on to a younger person. Unfortunately, I need to keep working for health care insurance. All right.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Mike says, unless the DNC owns up to what they did and issues a sincere apology, they will never get Bernie supporters' votes again. That's not if it's not too late because of the way they handled it. Barbara says the cost of the wall.
Oh, my goodness, stop.
What?
I think that Bernie Buster thing is just very dangerous. I think people need a civics 101.
Can you imagine saying, I'm never going to vote for a Democrat again?
How did that work out?
Well, exactly.
How did that work out so far?
As a person who really was pro-Bernie, at the end of the day, you have to look at the institution. Our institution and democracy is very critical. The role of a citizen to vote and engage. And many of these folks are just new-time voters. They figured that if my vote did not happen right then I'm going to walk away. Then if you walk away, then you've given weight to those who oppose you and your ideas.
You have voted, essentially.
And so the thing is that we really need a serious 101, for all Americans with regards to the importance of the democracy and their role to participate. Because at the end of the day, if we do not like what we're seeing that's happening at the national front and with our national leadership, all the more reason why we have to engage the citizens.
Well, JP,
and a lot of what Bernie's message was anti-establishment, anti-big money in politics, and that was something that he shared with Trump. And so these issues that Trump is bringing to the forefront, if Democrats want to win elections, I would encourage them to not call Trump voters ignorant, uneducated, you know, bigots and all that stuff. They should listen to the message and try and take the best things from that message and shape it for themselves so that they can win the next election.
And Bill Clinton understood that in 92 when he ran, and he understood economic insecurity across the spectrum, and he spoke eloquently, like few Democrats have in my memory, about economic insecurity, and he did something about it. He did something about
it. Okay, and Barbara says, if the cost of the wall is just a drop in the bucket,
it's not.
Why doesn't Trump pay for it out of his billions and add the cost of the wall to the cost of Secret Service overtime pay to cover his golf And Yo says, Andrew, my son, 18 years old, just reminded me that DJT said to President Nieto that he didn't want him to talk about Mexico not paying for the wall because it makes Trump look bad. Now, here he is demanding that taxpayers pay for this monstrosity. All right. And James says, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you think it's possible that Sally Yates could be convinced to step into the political arena? I seriously think she would be the best, most electable candidate for president the Democratic Party could offer.
What'd she do? Mm-hmm. What'd she do?
Alexa's looking at
it. Serious.
What did Sally Yates do?
Well, I mean, I know what she did of recent, but what is the background beyond that to be a president of the United States?
I thought they were made just for local officer.
And what did Trump do? No, she said no.
Was that for president? No.
But there are a number of former Obama administration folks who have now said that they're going to run for local office, for congressional office. Nancy Soderbergh, others who are... her now getting into the fray, but not for president.
Okay. I also think that having government experience is not necessarily a benefit to getting to elected office now that Trump has proven that out. Sorry, on to the next letter.
Mary says, getting things done. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
How more substantive can you get than gutting the EPA, thus giving climate change free rein and assuring a future of environmental and social disasters? And that's from Mary. Okay.
Michael and Bloomberg's doing great work on the side.
And Alan said, per USCourts.gov, there are 140 federal judge vacancies, 31 pending nominees. Teresa keeps saying they have been filled, but not yet. Not all of them. Okay.
They filled a whole group of them recently.
Yeah. I agree that it is a pending threat, but has not yet come to pass. And that's from Alan. And John says, dear Alan, spelled wrong, love the shows, would like to have your panel spend one show on what is happening behind the smoke and mirrors of Trump's actions. We've been talking about that. We've talked about it all day. I hear changes in the EPA, finance, healthcare funding, and other agencies that are being passed. People are not getting the full picture of what's really going on, and all we look at is tweets. Thank you, John.
Well, for instance, just yesterday I read that this is just a little anecdotal issue, but, and Aaron, you can speak more eloquently to this than I can, but there was rules that miners, coal miners, so mm-hmm. Trump says I'm all for the miners, they were doing a health study on those who were doing mountaintop mining.
Mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm. And so the companies had to do health monitoring, and then there was research going on about their health status, and they've eliminated the rule that they have to monitor, and they've cut the funding for this ongoing research about their health status.
Yeah, one of the things is when you prove that a activity, as they say, an industrial activity causes not only just environmental harm, but human health risk issues, the issue is who's liable. And clearly the government, if it does a peer-reviewed study and finds that the practices are still a threat to human health, and who's going to be paying for those long-term healthcare needs of miners? You know, people talk about that we've abandoned coal miners, but the reality is that the government and the taxpayer has been paying for special healthcare benefits for an entire industry and sector that's been getting great tax breaks and great support from the government, but it's not taking care of the health of its workers or transitioning them to cleaner energy industries or cycle, basically transitioning them, to, as I say, to a clean energy economy. But here's a classic case of here is something that even where they say it's a safer practice, that definitely has a human health outcome, and yet again, the government is slashing the funding to doing the study that monitors this population so that they can reduce the liability and risk to the corporation.
So Trump's on the side of coal miner owners, not coal
miners. Oh, absolutely.
Miners.
Absolutely. They've been the biggest champions for the absurd notion of clean coal. It's if there's anything... You know, I'm looking for the unicorn. I mean, when you say clean coal, I mean, I'm waiting for a unicorn.
Well, isn't Wilbur Ross?
Oh, Wilbur Ross, absolutely.
Commerce Secretary, isn't he a big investor, owner of coal mines?
I don't know if he is, but I think with the Trump administration and Trump isn't really interested in this stuff. It's really Republicans that are into this stuff, and their view is that the Obama administration overregulated these industries, and they're trying to roll back some of that. And that is not part of what I label. Of course, it's Trump enabling it, but it's more ideological conservatives that think that maybe Obama overreached.
But this is what happens when you don't vote.
Exactly. But there's another piece. You know, remember, any regulation, anytime you hold somebody, and I always tell people, think of regulation or red tape as something that somebody's paid for with life and limb. And it's red because of blood or the loss of life. And so people hear, let's get rid of red tape, but they don't realize that usually because of a change of train of industrial practices that resulted in harm to human health, the environment, that there's a reason why and a role for government to monitor that activity and to be the cop on the beat, so to say. And so when we start taking that cop off the beat, then those very people who are saying, let's get rid of red tape, and yeah, it makes sense, get rid of government. So what happens is that there's a conflating by the industrial, you know, sector and the average working guy thinking that the working guy, that the government, and as I say, the industry and the working guy are speaking in the same page, when actually, as in the case of the coal miners, government is actually the good guy here. And unfortunately, as they start pushing for more deregulation and rolling back government's role, there's less enforcement, less protection, and more risk and threats to individuals, their health, and the environment.
And also, new study out today, you know, they said it was all this investment in clean energy that's hurting coal, but it's actually natural gas. It's an investment in natural gas.
We had a note from somebody who said, let JP talk. JP, if you've been repressed in any way today,
I don't feel repressed, and in fairness, I don't know a lot about, you know, coal miners. Aaron is an expert in this stuff, and so I'm enjoying listening to him talk.
What about the presidency? What's this going to do to the presidency?
On the presidency, Trump is remaking the presidency, and he views success by winning re-election in 2020. He's right now at 34% approval. He was at 37% approval when he won election. And he views this as totally a black and white issue. Will he get re-elected? And I think if you ask me today, I think he has a reasonable chance of getting re-elected. He doesn't have zero chance of getting re-elected.
But is he weakening our democracy?
Well,
now you're
just getting
a
dismantle.
I think that's all about him, but what about that?
I think our democracy is really strong when you turn on television news and the media are constantly badgering and criticizing the president all day, every day. We all have a vote. We went out and voted. We had a peaceful transfer of power. We will have another peaceful transfer of power in 2020.
Well, no. Look, I agree with you about the peaceful transfer of power. We did have that, and that's one of the things this country has.
Could have been more peaceful.
On the other hand, what was the old country song? You cheated, you lied, you told me you love me. No, but remember the guy.
Anybody have the
Barnes? He lost the election popular vote.
That's correct.
So
he'd be happy to lose that popular election of vote again as long as he wins re-election.
Absolutely.
As long as he wins Pennsylvania, right. Michigan, Florida, Ohio.
Where he's running at about 33%
Can he do it without Russian help?
I think the FBI director James Comey delivered the election to him. There was NBC News piece on it the other day. The more that Democrats talk about Confederate statues and Russia, the more elections they're going to lose. They should talk about putting people back to work, et cetera.
Or taking down Columbus, the Columbus Monument and Columbus Circle.
Or not letting the local broadcaster Robert Lee call
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Football
unbelievable.
Game. Local Albany guy.
All right, we're out of time.
No.
My thanks to everybody for being with us. Did you have fun, Aaron?
Oh, absolutely.
Are you going to come back?
Oh, of course.
Excellent. Great. JP, we'll invite you. You're coming back Tuesday, right?
Yes, sir.
Keep your radio on,
that's
JP.
All, yeah,
keep
your radio, radio away, you know? I mean, JP can be riding down 890, and he hears a call, like the Batman sign.
And that's what we want from all of our panelists. We'll be back.